What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. Thank you so much for joining us. We have an amazing show for you here tonight. We're going to be speaking with Thomas Frank back from the wilderness and Matt Karp. But before we speak to those two gentlemen about how in the world Kamala Harris lost, we're going to be speaking to a very special guest who is going to be making her debut on the Katie Helper Show. And that is someone I'm going to bring up in 1 second. But before I do that, make sure you give this a like. Just give it a thumbs up. It's a really, really easy way to support the show. A thumbs up. Also subscribe if you haven't already subscribed. You can also become Patreon members at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Probably part of this will be Patreon only. So if you're watching live, you get to see the entire thing. If you're watching later on and you want to see the entire thing, go to patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Okay, I'm going to bring on our first guest and let me introduce you to her. Her name is Leah Kayali, and she's an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement, PYM, a transnational independent grassroots movement of young Palestinians and Arabs in diaspora. In her organizing, she has supported the Evict Elbit campaign, which ousted the weapons manufacturer from their innovation hub in Massachusetts and was involved in the Harvard Out of Occupied Palestine encampment. She is currently organizing with the PYM's Mask Off Mersh campaign, which aims to expose the logistics giant's role in facilitating the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. So welcome, Leah.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Katie.
Of course. So tell us about this Masks Off Mersh campaign.
Yeah, of course. So thanks again for having us. And, you know, I think where we can start with the Mask Off Mayors campaign, which we launched, the Palestinian Youth Movement launched in the spring of this year. So for months, we've been ringing the alarm bells that Maersk, which is a company many people have probably never heard of, but is actually one of the largest players in the shipping and logistics world, one of the most profitable companies in the world, is also one of Israel's leading partners in genocide. So for months, we have known that Maersk has been transporting hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons parts to companies like Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Elbit Systems. But, you know, this latest development in the campaign is that we were able to do some research and publish a report that shows not only sort of the general complicity that we knew Maersk was involved in, but actually the specific commercial lines that include shipments directly to the Israeli Ministry of Defense. So in the last year, our research shows that Maersk has facilitated over 2,100 such shipments to the Ministry of Defense, which totals tens of thousands of tons of military cargo. Many of these ships have docked in the port of Algeciras in Spain on their way to occupied Palestine to be used for the genocide. And so when we discovered that, we traced it back and realized that over 900 of these, you know, 2,100 plus shipments were actually in violation of the Spanish arms embargo. So when we published those reports on November 4th, Spain, you know, was pressured to respond to what we found. And they saw that, you know, in fact, of course, our findings were correct, that Spain was carrying military, or Maersk was carrying military cargo to the Israeli Ministry of Defense through Spanish ports. And they had to turn back three Maersk ships that were carrying such shipments. That happened on November 7th. And since then, we've seen those ships dock in the port of Tangiers in Morocco, where they were met with popular resistance, people taking to the streets, swarming the dock in protest, in opposition to their government's complicity. And since then, we suspect that these ships will be headed to occupied Palestine to be used in furtherance of the genocide. But this shift from being able to ring the alarm bells generally about this complicit company to being able to particularly identify the ways in which Maersk is complicit in the genocide gives a lot of power to this movement for a people's arms embargo.
Right. And so what is a people's arms embargo?
So the idea behind a people's arms embargo is that we have, you know, whether you're a Palestinian in diaspora like myself or someone in solidarity with our struggle, we've been for a year, over a year now, taking to the streets, trying to pull every lever that we can or that we're told in our society gives us power over our government. And we've seen that none of that has worked. Both the mainstream parties in the U.S. Have been completely in lockstep with Israeli interests. And, you know, a people's arms embargo is the demand that, you know, we see that this government has not even entertained an arms embargo of Israel, despite over 1 year of bankrolling and being a partner in their genocide. So we, the people, are going to, you know, enforce an arms embargo upon Israel. We will target the companies most directly complicit themselves. And so Maersk needs to be one of the main targets when we talk about that, because this is when we talk about shipping and logistics companies, they're the kind of companies that are the through line between all of the weapons manufacturers that you've heard about in the news. They're the vehicle, basically a merchant of death, transporting these parts of weaponry, parts of armored vehicles, tanks, you know, vehicles used as rocket launchers. Maersk is shipping all of those parts to be used in the genocide. So a people's arms embargo is going straight to the supply line that the Zionists are using to devastate Gaza.
And is this having any impact on the company's finances, on Maersk's finances?
So we haven't published any findings that, you know, of Maersk's finances yet, but we know that, you know, grassroots organizing has impacted war profiteers in the past, and we suspect that we can use that lever on Maersk too. For example, you know, I've previously been involved in an Evict Elbit campaign based in my locale out of the Cambridge and Boston area. We saw in that work that we were able to you know, contribute to an international campaign against Elbit Systems that did result in, you know, decreased financial success of Elbit, and also led to disinvestment from banks like Chase Bank, Scotiabank, that were invested in this company. So we suspect that, you know, a massive pressure campaign will reap those sort of rewards for the movement. And fundamentally, our strategy is to use our people power, the power of the masses, like the one tool that we have over our enemies, to, you know, change the equation of profit. We know that Maersk will, you know, drop these contracts when it's no longer profitable for them to be drenched in the blood of the Palestinian people.
Right. Now, Algeciras, by the way, that's how you say it in Spain with the zeta. I also want to share that I got very bad food poisoning there once. And when I was coming back from Morocco, we went to Algeciras and then took a train, and I got very, very bad food poisoning. So shame on them for that as well. Another attack that they are responsible
that's
for.
That's actually, yeah, that's the second demand of the campaign, actually, is to stop giving Katie
Thank
Helper
you.
Food poisoning.
Reparations for me and reparations for Katie Helper, yeah. Really, it was debilitating. I'm not going to get into details, but let's just say it was terrible for the people in the train car with me as well. So how and why did you target this company, and how did you find out what you have found out about them, to the extent that you can share that?
Yeah. So, you know, we did extensive research before even taking up Maersk as a target. You know, a lot of people would say, why not focus on, you know, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics? But the reality is that these companies like that have death built into their profit model. They will be able to absorb so much pressure against them because they are inherently aligned with imperial interests. If you're a weapons manufacturer based in the US or Israel, that is your goal. For a company like Maersk, they are a capitalist conglomerate. They will, like I said earlier, drop their contracts, we believe, if we're able to sustain enough pressure against them. For that reason, and because we could see that they had some of the highest complicity in the industry when it comes to their actual connections to those weapons companies and to the Israeli Ministry of Defense directly, Maersk, sort of was the obvious target for a people's arms embargo campaign. And when it comes to the research that we've most recently produced, this was a grassroots research effort run by our organizers, throughout the Palestinian youth movement, looking at, commercial documents called bills of lading that companies like Maersk have to report to the governments that they plan to dock in. And we were able to get information from those documents and look at the codes used in the product descriptions to figure out specifically what it is that Maersk has been shipping and to expose the fact that they've been flouting the Spanish arms embargo by shipping parts of weapons, parts of armored vehicles, tactical vehicles through Spanish ports.
Right. And we actually have some images. Let's take a look at this pretty inspiring protest that we saw taking place in Morocco. So there it is. That's at the port,
right? That's right. So we saw partners in Morocco mobilize pretty immediately as soon as the ship, the Maersk ship port docked in the port of Tangiers. It's worth noting that Maersk actually owns and operates two terminals in that port. So another reason we've focused on this campaign is through tracing Maersk's complicity, we're exposing a lot of what's wrong about a system run by capitalist and imperialist greed, that Moroccans don't even have a say. The people of Morocco are not able to exercise their power to prevent Maersk from docking. But we could see from that photo from the mobilization in the streets that Moroccans, the people of Morocco are against this complicity that Maersk, is docking.
Right. And we also have a great cover story from El País, which talks about what happened.
That's right. Yeah, so El País is the leading newspaper in Spain that was the first Spanish paper to break this story based on our research that we published with Progressive International. And this led, the investigation that El País reporters did led to basically progressive and left forces within Spain within Catalan to be pressuring the Spanish government to actually make good on the arms embargo that they had worked hard to get their government to pass.
Yeah. Yeah. So and saying how they blocked, they denied the docking of these two ships with arms for Israel. Let's look at, you guys have put out this really great report. I'm going to screen share for a second. And this report has some really important information and also images. So here's the report. As you can see, evidence of Maersk shipments to Israeli military. And here's a summary. Here is where you go through the shipments to Israeli Ministry of Defense over the course of a year. And you categorize everything. You talk about the number of shipments, the weight, the code. And here I want to show this image. So here is Israeli soldiers are seen on a Neymar APC near Palestine Square in Gaza City's Ramal neighborhood. So just so people get a sense of what kind of equipment is coming through, it's stuff like this.
Totally.
And look at like that disgusting devastation that they leave.
Like smug look of the soldiers too. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they have their thumbs up. They're smiling.
Yeah. And the Merkava obviously are three of the sort of, most widely used weapons of death, vehicles of death in Gaza. So when we talk about these armored personnel, carriers, if you're not someone familiar with military language, you might not realize that what we're looking at is basically a tank that is being used to pulverize the streets of Gaza. When we talk about something like the heavy tactical vehicles, they're called HEMTTs, the Oshkosh vehicles, which I believe, have another photo of at some point, or it's,
I'll go to that now.
Yeah. Next in the next photo in the report.
Yeah. This is really disgusting.
Yeah, I mean,
this one, people are probably have seen this.
Exactly, like,
absolutely disgusting.
These are the sort of vehicles and the parts of vehicles that Maersk is shipping to the Israeli Ministry of Defense. No middleman. Maersk is, going through other ports, of course, but to the Israeli Ministry of Defense directly. And, so these vehicles, like the Oshkosh Tactical, they're used for disgusting and depraved human rights abuses against our people in Gaza, like what we see depicted here, images of Palestinian men being rounded up and blindfolded and taken to torture or certain death. We still don't know, what happened to a lot of these men. And Maersk is facilitating all of this.
Right. And really disgusting and very inspiring to see you guys take this action. We also have a video of an action that happened. I guess this was the LA Mask Off October protest. Let's just take a look at that video that you guys at PYM organized. Great. So congrats on that, too. I want to speak of congratulations, not to give you a big head or anything, but you are a part of a very exclusive, very prestigious list of very important people. That is the Canary Mission list. Can you tell people briefly what the Canary Mission is and how you found yourself on it?
Canary Mission, for those who don't know, is a Zionist doxing website that targets anyone really who supports the Palestinian cause. I was first doxed on Canary Mission, I want to say, in like 2017, like 7 years ago, for some of my activism, when I was an undergrad student organizer. Since then, they have, really exhibited fan behavior of updating that page like every 6 months. But there are hundreds of organizers around the country that have been targeted by Canary Mission because they're trying to do what Zionists always do, which is, they can't fight our movement on the merits. And so they're trying to smear, distract, and defame, organizers in the movement.
Right. And tell us about your experience. Like, has that had a negative impact on you? Obviously, it hasn't stopped you from doing your organizing, but have they succeeded in getting you, banned from certain things, or like, do you think you've lost jobs because of it?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to doxing, I think, like I said, I have the privilege of having first been doxed 7 years ago, so I have quite some time to get right. used to this.
Ahead of the curve.
Yeah. I mean, I think like...
Not to brag.
I mean, yeah. Maybe it's just revealing my age, but like, I think when it comes to doxing, the reality is that, doxers are only as powerful as the movement is weak, right? The best response to doxing is to show massive collective power that people stand with the Palestinian cause. And that has been my experience, actually. Being listed on Canary Mission, having been doxed, on various other websites, really at the end of the day, has no power over me if I know that I have my community behind me, I have my comrades and fellow organizers behind me. And that nothing is going to stop us from being able to continue to do this work. I think, when people respond from a place of fear, when we see doxing and things like that come up, it's a very natural and normal response. But the reality is that when, the Zionist and right-wing movements use these tools against us, which are only going to increase as our movement grows, they will have diminishing returns because the movement is going to swell to meet the moment to support people who are in those situations. That was my experience for sure.
Right. And tell me about your family, your personal connection to Palestine.
Yeah, my family is from Jaffa and Lid in occupied Palestine. So that's in, what Palestinians refer to as 48 or Al-Dakhil, right. Also known as the State of Israel. And so my family was displaced in 1948. I still have family in the West Bank today. My experience as a Palestinian has been one of three generations of exile, of forced displacement. For those of us for whom that is our story, for whom, we were born and raised in exile, our existence in the movement, our insistence on, you know, pushing the issue of Palestine to the consciousness of people wherever we are. For me, it's in the so-called US, is an insistence on our identity and our liberation as Palestinians. Zionists thought that when they exiled 750,000 Palestinians in 1948, that they had, you know, extinguished us, but they didn't realize that we spread like seeds. And everywhere we've landed, the movement is only going to continue to grow. And that is the sort of foundational principle of the Palestinian youth movement around the work that we do and how we're able to actually build a movement strong enough to force responses from the government of Spain and build towards an actual people's arms embargo.
Yeah, it's really inspiring. And last thing I wanted to ask you about was your thoughts on the election.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a Palestinian. We had no hope in either of these candidates from the mainstream parties that were on our ballot. Obviously, the Arab American Muslim community, Palestinian community in particular, has been completely left out to dry by the Biden-Harris administration. And, you know, she had next to no popularity in our community. We also know that Trump is the president of the Muslim ban and is, you know, vilely Islamophobic and anti-Palestinian. And so what the election, I think, shows us is that we have to look for other avenues to build the world that we want to live in beyond reformist electoral politics. And that's actually the foundational logic behind the People's Arms Embargo campaign, too. You know, the story in The Intercept that broke our reporting went out on November 4th. That could have been completely lost to election cycle news. But instead, what we saw was that this story got picked up throughout the US, around the world, in Spain, and had massive ramifications for this company that we've been targeting, for a people's popular movement for Palestine throughout Europe and in Morocco. And so I think what that shows us is that, you know, this election cycle might leave people feeling demoralized or nihilistic about the state of our future. What I really think it should be showing people is that we are our future. No one is coming to save us except for us in organized people's movements. That's you know, what we're here to do in the Palestinian youth movement, what the People's Arms Embargo is all about. So if you're one of those people feeling like you've been left out to dry by electoral politics, join a movement, get organized, help us build a People's Arms Embargo so we can stop the flow of weapons to be used in the genocide against the people of Gaza.
Great. And we will link to your, we will definitely make sure to link to the PYM, Palestinian Youth Movement. Looks like there's some good news, by the way, which is that HR 9495 is officially defeated in the House.
Oh, amazing.
It didn't get the 2/3 majority vote needed to pass. And that is, wow, that's great. It would have empowered the Treasury Secretary to revoke nonprofit tax status of organizations based on judgments that they're terror supporting. Oh. Obviously, we know what would be who would be targeted by that. But that's some good news. So we got two pieces of good news. We got what you guys are doing at PYM, and then we got that. So which is we need all the good news we can get.
That's for sure.
So thank you so much, Leah, and come back on. And we'd love to have you on again and find out what's next for you.
Thanks
guys.
For having me, Katie.
Of course. Have a great
you
night.
Too.
Bye. Everyone, thank you so much for watching, and we're going to keep the show going. Let's see, how are we doing on likes? How are we doing on likes? I'm sorry to have to do this to you. I don't want to. 250? Guys, I really want to get this to at least 300. We're about to bring on Thomas Frank, which is pretty exciting. I think if you like the fact that we're having on Thomas Frank, the least you could do is give us a like. So let's see, where are we now in terms of likes? Okay, we made it to 300. Great. So without further ado, I'm going to be bringing on back to the show. We haven't seen him in a while, and so we are so excited to be bringing him back. In fact, he told me that he's been in the wilderness, and the only thing that brought him out of the wilderness, the only thing, is the Katie Halper Show. He told me very explicitly that this was the only thing he considered it worth reengaging with the media on. He can explain it himself, but we're going to bring on to the show the wonderful Thomas Frank, the journalist, cultural critic, historian, writer. He co-founded and edited the Baffler magazine and is the author of the books, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. and The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism, among others. So welcome, Thomas Frank.
What up, Katie Halper?
How's it going? Back together.
I'm not going to tell you until we get those likes to 350.
Oh, all right. Let's see. Where are we on the likes?
That's a joke. True. I didn't realize you actually did. You did. I don't even know what that is, but you know.
Oh, you give a thumbs up.
No.
And it's a way to spread the news, spread the word about the show, which of course is good. And it's a free way to support the show.
No, I'm just teasing you. I'm just teasing you. How are you doing?
I'm good. You?
Great.
Where have you been? I know you've been writing for European outlets.
Yes.
Because
yes.
If people don't know what happened is Thomas Frank was very popular on MSNBC when he wrote the book, What's the Matter with Kansas, which is what's wrong, which criticizes, of course, the Republican Party. But then he made the mistake of writing Listen Liberal. And shockingly enough, it didn't get the same reception at MSNBC.
But weirdly, so yeah, I sort of disappeared in this country from, you know, the electronic airwaves. But it didn't affect, you know, so in Europe, it did really well. Europe, Australia, Canada, places like that, it did great. So, you know, so I still write for like a French newspaper. But the main thing is I've been working on a new project, a new book, and I'm really deep into it. You know, you get into that where I've done this enormous amount of research and I know the subject forward and backward. And I'm very deep in writing it. But the election of Trump, you know, the impending, I guess it was the impending election of Trump. And then I had to stick my head back up for a little while. But I will disappear again in a few days. And then you won't have to worry about me.
Yeah. And what is your new book on? Or is that a secret?
It's not a secret. It's a history of creativity. The word.
Wow.
Not like the creative act itself, right? But the word and how it and then it's sibling innovation and where they came from, when they became a big deal. And it all starts right after World War II. It's a fascinating story. And it becomes an academic discipline. It becomes and there is a political side to this too. The various presidents use these words. Weirdly, Republicans like the word creative and Democrats like the word innovation. I know. It's like you wouldn't have predicted that, right? But
yeah.
But there's all sorts of absolutely fascinating sides to this. And that's what I've been working on. I'm very, very deep in it.
Nice. Well, attended both conventions. And of course, I'm very excited to have you on in conversation with Matt Carp, because both of you have a lot to say when it comes to how and why Kamala Harris lost. Yeah. But, and you of course wrote a piece. I can't believe the New York Times let you back.
Well, I'm a good writer. What are you talking about?
I did a good job. You write some painful truths and maybe they let you back because you were proven right. And we'll get to that piece in a second, but tell us what you saw at the conventions and whether you were able to predict and how you were able to predict the outcome of this election.
Oh, well, I didn't predict it in any public venue, just to my friends, you know.
Right.
But that was easy towards the end because they were tied in the polls. And we know, come on, we know we've been done this three times now with Donald Trump, the polls always underestimate his support. Right. And so that was, it was pretty easy to see that. Now, the interesting thing about, well, there's many interesting things about the conventions, but both conventions at the moment they happened, the parties were absolutely and utterly convinced that they had this thing in the bag, both of them. So the Republicans, remember, this is after, this is before Biden had withdrawn from the race. And so Trump has just come off of this debate with Biden, and it's absolutely, you know, devastating for poor old Joe. And then, Trump, you know, got shot in the ear. And then the convention was just a few days after that. And he was, he was the conquering hero. It was, you know, every speech was about him. So they did a lot of things at this convention that I've never seen any party do before ever. The main thing being, you know how the presidential candidate generally doesn't show their face until the final day of the convention, that, you know, they show up and accept the plaudit. Trump was there every single day, and he would enter the auditorium at a suitable hour, and they would stop whatever was going on the PA system would say, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Donald Trump or President Donald. And he would come out sort of like through the tunnel, like he's a sports team. This is in Milwaukee, in the basketball arena in Milwaukee. And then he would go very slowly up to his special chair. You know, he had this very special armchair, and his members of his family would sit there with him. But he, from that point on, every single speech was addressed to him. He was an audience of one, you know, and every speaker would start out by talking about how great he was and how thankful they were that God had spared his life. And when the flattery would really get thick, the cameras would go to Trump. So you couldn't see this at home, but on the Jumbotron in the auditorium, when they flattered him, there would always be a camera would go to Trump's face, and he wasn't mic'd up, but you could see his lips move, and he would say, "Thank you." And so you could watch the speaker heaping flattery on Trump and then watch Trump accepting the flattery at the same moment. It was pretty freaky.
Wow.
It's also the security was much tougher than ever before. So there were two security perimeters at both of the conventions, and the Republican convention was not crowded. So I had no trouble getting a floor pass. I was 20, 25 yards from Trump when he spoke. I was down there, and I saw Kid Rock. I was right in front of the stage. I saw Hulk Hogan.
How were they?
Well, they were extraordinary. They were something else. And so were a lot of the speakers were very passionate and actually, rather good. The huge letdown was, of course, Trump himself. This is like the 4 days of buildup for this guy, right? Where they're talking about how great he is and how prayerful they are, about it and thankful they are about that he survived the assassination. It's on and on, right? It goes on and on and on, right? And then it's finally his turn, and he comes out there, and he was boring. It was crazy. He was actually boring, and he talked for an hour and a half. And this is in this where I was standing was so packed you couldn't move. I have neglected to wear, I'm old now, Katie, and I have to wear compression socks for something like this.
Yeah.
And I forgot to do it. Yeah. And I forgot to do it. And it was very uncomfortable. And I looked around after about like an hour into this, I looked around at the rest of the audience, and people's eyes were glazed over. And you could see you could see this in the auditorium, but not at home. You could see what his script was, because they don't use teleprompters, classic teleprompters anymore. They have this big sort of screen at the back of the auditorium that the speaker himself or herself can see and read their words from. So you can see the prepared text, and you can see when Trump is just ad-libbing, which was all the time. He's just making stuff up, just telling these wacky anecdotes. Anyhow, it was whatever. And then I went to the Democratic convention as well. They were both within 100 miles of each other. So I stayed at the same place and just went back and forth. But the Democrat, do you want to hear this? I mean, I don't think you want to hear this.
Yes.
I don't think you do.
I do. Why? Why do you say that?
Because it's boring. It's all, it's all in the rearview mirror.
No, tell us about, I actually think what's interesting about the Democratic convention, speaking of the way that he disrupted the formatting, was I remember Kamala Harris spoke, I think the first night,
they
right?
Do, they often do like this when now, you, the Democrat, they do it, they do
like,
a cameo.
It's like opening with the headliner.
Yeah. No, she came out and greeted everybody and then went, and then disappeared again. But the Democratic one was in a bigger arena, the United Center in Chicago, much larger crowd, and then this huge presence of protesters who never the idea was to pull off some kind of 1968 scenario, but they never got close to that. And every time I went I went to the protest too, or I tried to do both, right? And every time I went over there, they were in a park right near the United Center. And every time I went over there, they were pretty massively outnumbered by the Chicago police, who were absolutely determined to not recreate 68. And so they didn't beat anybody up, and there was no, you know, none of that kind of, you know, police riot kind of scenario. But it was absolutely fascinating in many, many ways and for all sorts of reasons. It was totally scripted. There was not a note of dissent. And they went through these speeches very quickly. They were all 5 minutes long. Some were shorter than that, just running people through. And they all say the same thing. And it's very tiresome after a while. And you're like, why am I here? Why am I doing this? This is these very uncomfortable seats. The food is really bad and really expensive. You know, I love Chicago, by the way. It's one of my very favorite places in the world.
Yeah.
But it was tough. And the main motif, if you had to say that there was a motif, it was moral goodness. Yeah. Right. And everybody enjoy. Joy. They didn't talk about that so much, but they did. They talked about them. You know, they're every speaker comes out and like they recite a kind of resume of moral goodness. And the reason this struck me as being like really, you know, weird and ineffective is because that's not persuasive. You know, the way it works when you're, you know, at least when you're giving a sermon is your conversion story. I was a sinner and then I discovered the light or whatever. And there's none of that. It's like, my parents were excellent and I am excellent. And I went through this adversity and got more excellent. You know, just like it's really not a very interesting story. But what makes it fascinating is you would, you know, and it's in this really, really massively air-conditioned space where they've got it cranked down to like 65 degrees. And you go outside and you're immediately struck by two things, the heat and then the Gaza protesters are out there with a megaphone. And when you walked out of the building, at least this happened on one day, it was really striking to me. You walked out of the building and a protester was reading the names of all of children killed in the war in Gaza, in the Israeli offensive. Right. And then every now and then pausing. And
they were like that.
They were tuning it out. But every now and then the woman with the megaphone would stop and would say, you know, you Democrats have blood on your hands. You specifically, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, have blood on your hands. So it's the exact opposite of this refrain of moral goodness that you hear inside the building. And that felt shocking to me. But evidently, Katie, I'm the only one who was shocked by it. There's not a single other reporter even so much as mentioned this. So I don't know. But and then there were interesting speeches here and there at both of the conventions. You know, the one that would have really shocked you, I don't know if you caught this, was the Teamsters president speaking at the Republican convention. Mm-hmm. And he was basically saying the kind of things that I used to say, you know, that I used to say on this show. And like people would, if I said that to Republicans, they'd call me a communist. And they had this guy. This guy was one of their featured speakers at the Republican convention. It was
How did they get him, by the way?
I don't remember the story. I think the Teamsters, like many of the big industrial unions, are in a, you know, between a rock and a hard place because a lot of their rank and file really likes Donald Trump. And the leadership, you know, generally speaking, does not like Donald Trump. And so there's this conflict. So they have to try to, you know, they don't want to blow off their rank and file. They don't want to blow off their own members. So they, you know, I think that's what he was doing, was trying to do a balancing act, but it really came off wrong because of course, Biden did these enormous favors for the Teamsters Union. And so it's kind of a bizarre. Now he did not endorse Trump in his speech. But he did, like every other speaker there, talk about, I think he called him a tough SOB or something like that.
Right.
And what did Kid Rock call him? An American badass?
Oh, my God.
Well, by the way, that's another thing. Nobody reported that Kid Rock sang this song about Donald Trump, about what a badass he is.
Well, Thomas, you know, what's the other interesting thing is that you talked about the Gaza protesters and how the Democrats were praising themselves as a morally
constantly
righteous
it's all they talk about.
Party.
Yeah.
And then you saw these DNC people were walking past the protesters and they literally went like that. Yeah. Like they put their fingers in their ears, which is quite a metaphor, not just for, I mean, the way that they took, responded to the protests about the people being killed in Gaza, but also one could say the way they kept their fingers in their ears about people telling them, we want you to do this if you want our vote.
It's sort of an image that really says it all.
Fell on deaf ears, literally fell on deaf ears. Yeah. And you have a, I mentioned this New York Times piece, so let's just read.
Yeah, but you should mention, first of all, before go into this, I write some version of this story
Every four years.
I return and I write. Right. And I remember the first time I did it, it was in 2004. What's the Matter with Kansas had just hit. And I was very much in demand back then. Like I would be on the radio and I, you know, whatever. But I wrote some version of it. And I remember writing it because I did it in a, I did it in between like radio and TV hits. And I think I wrote it in about an hour. But I write and rewrite the same goddamn thing. The one I did about...
You just have to swap things out?
It's fresh every time. It's completely new every time. Okay. But the one I wrote about Hillary, that was the all-time champion because I wrote it before. I think you remember this. I wrote it. Wrote it before the election happened. And it was in The Guardian, and The Guardian was sitting on it, and they put it up on their website the minute the AP called. A second after the AP called the election, they pushed publish on it. And what's the reason I remember it so fondly is because not only was it a really good story that I had really worked on and et cetera, but I was the only one that had it. The Guardian was the only paper that had a Trump win story. The Washington Post had prepared nothing. The New York Times had prepared nothing. And so they, for about 24 hours, they were the only ones with a really good, well thought out Trump win story. Now, I was very proud of that achievement, but it's funny. It really backfired on me.
Because people are mad that you knew why it happened?
The Guardian loved it. And like readers in England and Australia, New Zealand were very, it was a big deal, but in this country, it was like the kiss of death. It was like, what had I done? You know, how could he do something like that? Well, I do it every 4 years.
But what did you do wrong? Like you should have said that
it was correct.
Fascism is on the rise. What were they mad at you about?
That's right. Well, no, because I said the same thing. I said that it's a failure of the Democratic Party, and I put the blame on the Clinton campaign, I didn't mention Russiagate. And you know, all through those years, I never mentioned Russiagate. I never wrote about it. I never went on TV and talked about it. I never said a word about it because it wasn't true, Katie.
Yeah.
But you know how easy that was to see?
How much did Putin pay you to say that, Tom?
You know, but you know why I never wrote about it and I never went out and researched it. I never it's like that story stank from day one because it was so obviously served the agenda of these powerful people. I mean, so it's the kind of thing where a journalist should have been, instead of like, you know, like racing to get on that bandwagon, they should have been like, this is really suspicious. You know, this story has a very suspicious side to it, but they did the opposite. And, you know.
Yeah. As Aaron Maté calls it, who's like one of the biggest critics.
I used to be on your show all the time. I know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he calls it a privilege protection racket, Russiagate, because that way none of the consultants had to look at what they did wrong. So do you want to talk about your article?
Sure, yeah. You can put it up now. I just wanted to do that preamble.
All right.
Everything I do is so long-winded. I'm like, Katie, give me 10 seconds to set this up, and then I talk for 10 minutes.
Right. Okay. So before you start your 10-hour monologue, no, I'm just kidding. You're a very engaging speaker, obviously, everyone. Oh.
Yeah, you got the ads there anyway. You have to scroll down.
What is that?
It's just an ad.
An investment thing. I know, but okay. The elites had it coming. Yeah. Biden, America last, that says. And then the part I wanted to read was you write here, you say, am I showing the article?
Yeah, you are. That's it.
Okay, yeah.
I wrote that the other day.
Nice. Well, those tech-minded Democrats got exactly what they set out to get. And now here we are. At the Republican convention in July, J.D. Vance described the ruination visited on his working class town in Ohio by NAFTA and trade with China, both of which he blamed at least in part on Mr. Biden, and also the human toll taken by the Iraq War, which he also contrived to blame on Mr. Biden. Today, Mr. Vance is, although he wasn't, he did vote for it. Today, Mr. Vance is the vice president-elect.
No, that's right. That's what he said. Keep going.
And what I hope you will understand, what I want you to mull over and take to heart and remember for the rest of your life is that he got there by mimicking the language that Americans use to associate with labor, with liberals, with Democrats.
Correct.
By comparison, here is Barack Obama in 2016 describing to Bloomberg Business Week his affinity for the private sector. Just to bring things full circle about innovation, the conversations I have with Silicon Valley and with venture capital pulled together my interest in science and organization in a way I find really satisfying. So keep going.
I hope Mr. Obama finds his Silicon satisfaction. I hope the men of capital whose banks he bailed out during the financial crisis show a little gratitude and build him the biggest, most expensive, most innovative presidential library of them all. But his party is in ruins today without a leader and without a purpose. And then I go on and go after, oh, yeah, their stupid eternal strategy. It would have been nice, Katie Halper, if the Democrats could have triangulated their way into the hearts of enough educated and affluent suburbanites to make up for the working class voters they've lost over the years. But somehow that strategy rarely works out. They could have gone from boasting about, You ready? I got to switch my voice slightly.
Okay.
They could have gone from boasting about Dick Cheney's endorsement to becoming a version of Mr. Cheney themselves, and it still wouldn't have been enough. A party of the left that identifies with people like Mr. Cheney is a contradiction in terms, a walking corpse.
Well said. Very, very excellent article. And, very satisfying read. And yeah, I mean, I don't know how anyone, well, we're going to get to Matt Karp is joining us soon. And I cannot wait to show you guys some really great videos, by the way, that I think you're going to really like about how much introspection the Democrats are engaging in.
Spoiler alert, they're not.
Yeah, it's not.
I'm going to go to that convention too.
Yeah.
You know what's really funny, Katie? It's Kamala Harris continues to spam me.
you know who spams me all the time?
Trump.
Elise Stefanik. And they call me Al. Somehow someone gave my email to the Republicans and they think I'm Al Halper. I guess there must be a guy out there named Al Halpern or Al Halper.
Isn't that the name of that author from the 30s, the proletarian fiction writer? Remember you came over to my house once. I have all of his novels.
Yeah, right.
This is one of my hobbies is I collect proletarian fiction from the 1930s.
Wait, why don't we want to tell Matt Karp?
I'm just kidding. Yeah, but there was an author with your name, and I think it was Albert Halper. I'm trying to remember.
Oh yeah,
but I've got his book. So he wrote a really good piece of proletarian fiction, and then he wrote some that were not so good, and then you know, but it was a very short-lived moment in American literature, which makes it a good thing to collect because you can get them all, you know?
Right. Yeah. Didn't my mom give you a book during COVID? Yes, and I've got
to return it. It was right after COVID. I came to your house after it ended.
Right. Because you happen to be going to Pennsylvania, which is not far from where my parents are.
That's right.
We won't name the town. Yeah.
my visit to the Halper family seat. Yeah.
Yeah. Cute little doggy. Remember Bodie? Sure. She's famous. Sure. Bodie's famous because she was on Democracy Now! Because when Breonna Joy Gray got fired, Amy Goodman mentioned that I also had been fired from The Hill. And my Twitter photo happens to be me carrying Bodie. So now Amy Goodman knows who Bodie Halper is. And let's see. So Matt is coming to join. And then we're going to get to the, I'm very excited to show you guys. So we talked about your article. And we're going to talk about Matt's article in Jacobin.
I'm sorry. I meant to read that and I didn't get around to it. I apologize.
Okay. It's okay. That's all right. I mean, we'll have it on the screen. He's saying his computer's being weird. I'll try phone. Sorry. Uh-oh.
Well, I can blab about whatever you want. It's not a problem, Katie.
Shut up. Oh, there's Matt. Is that? Oh, hold on. Let's see how this is. Hi, Dr. Karp. How are you?
Hey, how's it going? Sorry, just got the kids to bed.
Okay.
And just getting my act together. How are you?
Good. Matt and Thomas Frank, Matt Karp and Thomas Frank. I don't know if you guys have met virtually or in person yet.
All right. Never met. We talked on the phone once, I think. Yeah, I think we had a chat somehow. We emailed and then we had a phone call. Was I giving you stock market tips? Yeah.
It was like, tell me about your experience on the Katie Halper Show. Well, for those of you who don't know.
We talked about how much we love the Democrats.
Aren't they the best?
Matthew Karp is, let me just tell people who don't know, Matthew Karp is an associate professor of history at Princeton University and the author of This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. And he's also a contributing editor, right, at Jacobin.
Yep.
And his work has appeared in The Nation, The Boston Review, and The London Review of Books. And he's working on two new books. And we can talk about that later. But let us just jump into this. Do you guys want to keep kibitzing or do you want me to show the article that you wrote? Well, that's awkward for you, Matt. You obviously can't say, I don't want to kibitz and show the article. So let me just bring up this article really quickly and then we'll get to kibitzing some more. Okay, so it's interesting because Thomas's article is called The Elites Had It Coming. And Matt's article, which is in Jacobin, was called It's Happening Again. Yeah. And until Democrats can find a way to win back some large chunk of working class voters, Donald Trump's successors will be favored in the next presidential election, too. So I wanted to ask you, Matt, because you're good at this kind of wonky, nerdy stuff. And then we're going to get into how and why this happened. But let's talk about the what. So what actually happened this election? Like, how did Kamala Harris lose? What happened demographically?
Well, I'm at a disadvantage because I was doing, bedtime stories. So I haven't heard, Tom's laid it all out for you already.
No,
so
I was just blabbing.
We were really talking about the conventions.
Okay.
Yeah, so we. Yeah.
Well, what happened? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I live in liberal land, like many, many of you. And I think everyone was afraid that 2016 was going to happen again. Like we've seen this tape before, it's not. And somehow everyone found lots of different reasons for why it wouldn't happen again. And then it did happen again. It was a different segment of working class voters who in the end rebelled against, left the Democratic coalition. But it was in scale broadly similar and in form and in result identical. I guess more overwhelming in that, this time Trump won the popular vote. But yeah, I mean, essentially, and of course the conjunctural factors are different. It was a different moment. It was a lot more inflation. We talked about this time a lot less about trade. I don't think people were thinking Kamala Harris was they weren't really pinning NAFTA on her in any direct sense in the same way that people did the TPP with Clinton. There are obviously sort of different policy issues in the mix. But I think fundamentally, the sort of it is happening again element is people had in trying economic circumstances, people had little reason to believe that the Democrats, for all of their promises, were actually willing to stand up for them. And as a result, preferred to pick, somebody who even has wavered between making promises to stand up for them and just flatly telling them that that they don't matter, but at least is candid about it. And right. I think both Harris, and Clinton sort of were trying to have everything both ways on the economic front and succeeded in convincing, I won't say very few, but just not enough, a decreasingly small share of the working class electorate that the Democrats were still the party of, ordinary workers.
Right. Well, I wanted to, and let's talk, we can talk more about the gains they made, because I wanted to ask both of you about the significance of trotting out Liz Cheney. And of course, Tom, at the end of your article, you called that party a party that goes to Dick Cheney, and Liz Cheney is a corpse. And of course, Dick Cheney is close to being a corpse. So that's a good metaphor. But tell us about why Kamala Harris chose to appear with Liz Cheney so much.
Look, my take on that is I think one of the really devastating things about it, you remember I in my New York Times article, I quoted from J.D. Vance's speech at the Republican convention. And one of the things that he did in that, which I kind of snickered at the time, you know, sitting up there in the bleachers, was when he tried to blame the Iraq war on the Democrats. You know, what a strange, silly move that is, right? Everybody knows that that was George W. Bush's baby. And then all we got,
but it was bipartisan.
It was bipartisan, but I'll be damned. Then they go out and choose to campaign with, right, with the mastermind of the whole thing. So why did they do it? I think it's the same strategy that they have been trying again and again and again for years. And the same strategy that I used to argue with these political science types here in D.C. about, which is they have this idea of the median voter. I forget what's the name of the theory, Matt. You know this. What, the median voter hypothesis, is that what it is?
Yeah,
yeah. That's the idea is that we know where the swing voters are because of math. You know, geometry. They're in the middle, and they are these suburban Republicans. You know, people like the people I grew up around who are, you know, conservative on economic issues, but are fairly tolerant people in most other ways. And they always go back to this strategy, always, 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 because that's kind of who they identify with. And so they tried it again and they tried it again. And at the same time, while they tried it, they downplayed or ignored or completely forgot about the handful of really pretty decent things that Biden did that you could build a campaign around to appeal to. I'm about to say something that is always shocking to the political science mind. There's another group of swing voters in America, and they're not like right there in the middle like that. They're not, you know, affluent suburbanites, and it's the working people that the Democratic Party has been hemorrhaging for decades now. And that's the, you know, this much, in my opinion, a much more significant group of swing voters, but they always forget about those guys. And so they forgot about the, I mean, it's not like Biden was great or anything, but he did take really important steps. You look at what he did on antitrust. This is huge. That was a really big deal. And now I know it hasn't trickled down to people's lives yet, but it's still something that you can talk about and you can build up and you can tell a story about. And she didn't do any of those things. Biden also, his sort of amazing outreach to organized labor. Now, again, it hasn't had, you know, great effects on people's everyday lives, but it will someday if you keep following. Anyhow, she chose to just drop all that stuff as though it had never even existed. I only heard at the convention. Now, to their credit, they did have a lot of speakers from organized labor at the Democratic convention, because they understand now, I mean, too little too late, right? But they do understand now that they've got to shore up their support with this group. But I only heard one speaker refer to the antitrust stuff. And then it was just in passing in a long list of things. And they never made a big deal about it at all.
I mean, sorry, Tom.
Go ahead.
Narratively, I think you're so right about this, and I hadn't made this connection about the narrative. I mean, it was such a layup for them in a certain sense. And I remember a Times op-ed from Jed Purdy a few months ago, sort of actually trying, you know, actually dropping the left wing, you know, sort of the pose of left wing confrontation, and sort of, you know, almost willing sort of to get on board and join the kind of Kamala brain trust and say, look, you guys want to have this freedom agenda. You're all about freedom and whatever that means for American foreign policy. You know, I'm sure we don't like it, but here's how you can talk about antitrust and monopoly and corporate power and the power of bosses and labor and capital. And here's how you can talk about it in democratic friendly language, like freedom. It doesn't have to be, you know,
like the proletariat.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to sort of bring in the talking points from, you know, the Jacobin Reading Group. You can kind of do it like Bill Clinton would have, you know, and yet you just hit these notes, or, you know, honestly, like FDR would have. Obviously, that's trite, or any Harry Truman, whatever. And like they that was there for them, actually, given, as you say, Tom, like some of the things that they did kind of on the margins that probably didn't affect the shape of the economy very much and definitely didn't affect anyone's lives, and they didn't get rewarded for it. But it would have been enough for them to say, look, here's why we are really the party of, you know, here's why we are really the only party that has even a chance of standing up against corporate power. But they made no effort, You know, and even when Harris was, you know, riding high, that was just not on the agenda.
And wasn't she hamstrung by the fact that her brother-in-law, we now know from this allegedly from that Atlantic piece where a Biden campaign person said that she stopped talking about antitrust because her brother-in-law, Tony West, who's an executive at Uber, told her not to pursue it.
Well, that's the theory. We don't really know. I said allegedly. That is her brother-in-law,
and he is an Uber executive. Yeah. But something I want to ask both of you about is, and this I've actually seen a debate about this on the left. There's been kind of like an intra-left debate about this. Because to me, it's very clear that there was a messaging failure. No matter what, there was a messaging failure. But for Bernie Sanders, he explicitly is saying it's not just a messaging failure, it's a policy failure. So let's take a look actually at this clip where we're going to hear from what Bernie Sanders has to say. It's actually, I think they're just quoting him. Sorry, one second. I have a bunch of different clips, so let me line this one up.
Katie, you're always 10 tabs deep, I know.
I know, I do have tabitis. Okay, clip 5, please, Brad. Start at 15 seconds.
Some blaming Joe Biden for not getting out of the race early. Others blaming their message. Some blaming liberals for pushing their party's message too far to the left. Others saying that it did not cater to their base and went after moderates instead at the expense of their progressive base. And you're starting to see some of this play out in public as well. A couple examples of just that. Bernie Sanders, of course, the independent who caucuses with Senate Democrats, put out a tweet earlier today saying that it should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party, which has abandoned working class people, would find that the working class has abandoned them. But then some folks who are not aligned with that wing of the party, the left wing of the party, have went after people like Bernie Sanders. This is what Richie Torres said, who's a Democratic congressman from New York. He
friend
said, Donald Trump has no greater friend than the far left, which has managed to alienate historic numbers of Latinos, Blacks, Asians, and Jews from the Democratic parties. He went on to criticize the so-called defund the police movement, among other issues as well. This all comes as the Democrats in the Senate and the House are grappling, at least in the Senate for certain, about life in the minority, about how to position themselves with this new Republican majority. Do they go toe-to-toe, act like a resistance, try to block the Republican efforts at every turn? They try to cut deals with the new Republican majority. That'll be part of the debate going forward. We don't know if the House Democrats, Jake, will be in the minority yet, but with things trending in that direction, that's going to be a big question for the Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, as well.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so obviously,
have you ever noticed how sad Jake Tapper looks?
Oh, always. Yeah. Well, he's still sad because for some reason, they didn't name Josh Shapiro for some reason, because he's the anti-Semitism czar, Jake Tapper. He even invented some anti-Semitism that did not exist at all when he and Dana Bash lied and said Rashida Tlaib had criticized the Attorney General of Michigan.
Katie, I just meant to point out that he's sad, that he looks sad.
All right, fine. But I'm connecting the dots. it's the trauma, the surus.
I forget what we were even talking about. Oh, blaming Bernie. By the way, Bernie is right about that. That's the story of Listen Liberal, right? I mean, you and I, we used to talk about this all the time, Katie, on your show. We talked about it so much that I'm tired of talking about it. But, you know, you go back to the 70s and 80s and the 90s when this faction of the Democratic Party was coming up, you know, the people who now run the thing, the people who now own it. And they were like very clear about their what they thought about working people. And it wasn't flattering that, you know, the future belongs. Remember, they called them the Atari Democrats. And then that you had this group called the neoliberals. And then you had the Democratic Leadership Council. And these guys were they all shared this sort of vision of the future and of the social class that owns the future. And that social class, right? It's people who can code or you know what they had all these names for them, the wired workers. Do you remember this? The learning class. I love that one, the learning class. So some people are in the working class and other people are in the learning class.
Corporate creative.
Well, the creative class is another big one. I wasn't going to go there because I'm writing about.
Conflict of interest.
Yeah, that's what I'm writing about right now.
But what is interesting is, and this is the debate I've heard from some people, like some leftists say, who are kind of policy wonks that I know who really like Bernie. They're like, well, no, because Biden did all these good things for the working class. So it's more, he overstated it. Bernie overstated it.
Or did Biden under, you know, under deliver? Look, right. So that's it's an interesting point, because it's not wrong. Biden did, you know, Biden's heart was,
let's not talk about the heart. Let's talk about the policy.
It's hard to say nice things about Biden now, because it's all ended so badly.
I blame his wife, not to be mean about it, but she should have. Oh yeah. Oh well. I forgot about that part too.
And, I mean, on and on right. and on. But wait. You said something important there, which was you made a reference to Shakespeare, and I think that Biden is kind of a tragic figure in a lot of ways. I think Biden
with a lot of blood of Palestinians on his hands.
Yeah. But Biden also
like most Shakespearean figures.
yeah. There you go.
There is blood on the hands.
Yeah.
But I think Biden also, to a certain degree, would get what we are talking about, and he, like, if you showed him,
or at least would pretend to get it, unlike Kamala Harris. That's my opinion. But
he's old enough so that he remembers a different Democratic Party. There's not many guys like that running around anymore. You can literally count them on one hand, and one of them was Sherrod Brown, and he just went down. So the number of Democrats who get what we're talking about and agree with what we're talking about, and I think Biden was possibly part of that group. Now, what he did was very, as we said before, it was baby steps. It was tiny. It was never anywhere near enough. I mean, look, he did these huge, massive spending programs on infrastructure and manufacturing, and it's like they're just getting started. It's like, you know,
that's 10-year horizons. Yeah,
it's like Trump is going to harvest all the electoral gratitude for those things.
On the policy front, I mean, here's the narrative, right? I mean, actually, this was a hammer blow was just delivered. I think actually we are seeing some signs of dissent in this moment from strange places. Like, for one, you had that thread that, you know, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, not exactly, you know, Sherrod Brown union guy, but, you know, was willing to actually sort of, you know, do the Sanders analysis on the Democrats. That was promising. And then, Annie Lowry in The Atlantic just wrote a piece just basically about going through the sort of failure of this, like, deliverism theory, like, oh, look, Biden did it. It's like, look, let's review the actual chronology of the Biden administration. It begins with this huge spending boom on the heels of COVID that's actually was started under Trump and then continues over into Biden. You have this temporary welfare state that does all these magical things that we thought were impossible, like eliminate child poverty.
Yes.
Wait a minute. The government can do that if it wanted to. And it suddenly, for strange reasons, unusual reasons, it wanted to, and it did. And then you had cash, you had Medicaid,
student loans.
You had all sorts of stuff that people were sort of getting and feeling. And so, and then the actual lived experience of the Biden administration is each one of those things, like a Jenga tower being pulled and pulled and pulled away as they lapse and as they are not recovered. You have the Democrats have this tiny coalition. And even if you are to credit that they had an ambitious agenda, even if you were to say they really wanted to do Build Back Better, which is a far cry from social democracy, but still would have been somewhat ambitious. And yet they get only, you know, a sixth of that, if anything. And most of it is green energy subsidies and factory and money for infrastructure factory that's going to take 10 years. And if you don't have one of those projects built in your backyard, you literally don't see it at all. And so it means nothing. And then meanwhile, at the same time, you have inflation that is starting to nip at your heels and run away and eat into those wage gains. And yeah, it's funny because the sides have flipped a bit. Whereas in the debates of 2022, 2023, the progressives were all like, oh, Larry Summers, now, sit down, be quiet. Inflation isn't a real thing. We got to keep spending.
Yeah, he was.
And
he,
now
he called that, like, one, didn't he?
you have to give the devil his due because look, he pointed out at the time that a lot of these contemporary inflation metrics, that like the CPI and stuff and others, you know, labor unions point this out too, that they don't include food, fuel, they don't include housing credit, they don't include the sort of substance of working class life, the pillars of the American economy. They include, like, you know, manufactured goods and, you know, toasters and stuff. And it's great that the inflation, you know, wasn't so bad for toasters, but it mattered a lot more for the weekly grocery bill. And like, and I think, and I do think that the Bidenomic, you know, wizards and all of the people with their charts and their wages and the, you know, Biden's halved inequality, blah, 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 really missed out on not just the felt texture of life, but the actual experience of life for people who are trying to pay their bills. And so what you actually had, if you're a working class voter in America, is you had things being taken from you And then you had prices coming after you. And then meanwhile, you had a bunch of Democratic pundits saying, hey, we never had it so good. Yeah. You never had it so good.
But the last part there is just, it's received by people as just being insulting. You know, when you tell them, no, this is so wonderful. God, where was I going to go with this? I forgot. I was going to say, I'm older than you guys, and I remember inflation wrecking Jimmy Carter's presidency, and before that, wrecking Gerald Ford's presidency. It's just so much more devastating than any of these guys understood. And then, talking about, well, now it's gone down, and so now we don't have to worry about it anymore. It's like, no, there's Trump is, remember, he's running on nostalgia, not just nostalgia for this vague past when things were great, but also for nostalgia for 5 years ago, you know, before all this stuff happened.
When cereal was $2.99. Yeah.
Yeah. And he has no right claim. Yeah. He doesn't have a good claim to that, but that doesn't matter. He was president then, and he can make it happen. Did you see his signs towards the end? Trump will fix it.
Yeah, Trump will fix it.
And it can be anything. It's anything. It's whatever. Like, yeah. He's going to Muslims in Dearborn and Hamtramck, right?
Oh, my God. And he said he went to Trump Dearborn and said to them, Liz Cheney, her father killed a lot of Muslims.
Oh, my God. Did he really say that? I didn't know he said that.
Of course. Yes.
Oh, my God.
He actually said that in Michigan. And then the Democrats send Bill Clinton to chastise the Muslim and Arab Americans for not appreciating that the Jews were there first. He literally said that. And he used the term Judea Samaria. And he also said, oh, yeah. Do we have that anywhere, Brad?
I saw people tweeting about it, but then the clip didn't have him saying that. And I was like, no,
it does. No, there are two clips and one of them has it. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. There's Brad, there's a Prem Thacker. He tweeted two things in a row. I can also send you.
No, I don't want to see it.
He also said that Hamas uses them as human shields. So it's unfortunate that a lot of people are dying, but that's what happens because of Hamas. And then meanwhile, you get Trump and I always say this thing about Trump is no one ever expects any ideological consistency from him. So he gets to own people all the time, because when he points out their hypocrisy, their hypocrisy seems hypocritical and his hypocrisy just seems like baked into it. And no one really cares.
He's just an American badass. He's just doing what badasses do.
I've been sharing this anecdote, but my friend, my Irish Catholic Long Island friend, told me a family story from Long Island where his aunt posts on Facebook on election day, I am so proud to support President Trump. We've never had a stronger president for life, defending life and eliminating the scourge of abortion. And meanwhile, his niece and another sort of wing of the family post on the same day, I'm so proud to support President Trump, finally a Republican who's sane and moderate on abortion. We get behind him. And it's like somehow he's like, they're literally, not only are they supporting him despite having different positions on the same issue, they're supporting him precisely because of his position on this issue, which is two things at once. Yeah. It's a Jedi classic move.
It's classic. I don't know if anybody else can pull that off. I would say Bill Clinton, but.
But I think he lost the touch.
Let me talk.
Here it is.
Has he ever?
Let me talk about the hardest issue here in Michigan is the Middle East. Hamas did not care about a homeland for the Palestinians.
He's old.
They wanted to kill Israelis and make Israel uninhabitable. Well, I got news for them. They were there first. Before there was their faith existed, they were there. In the time of King David, in the southernmost tribes, had Judea and Samaria.
Wow.
So here's what I'm going to
do. Bill Clinton got old. I'm going to do everything I can.
That they cannot murder their way out of this. Neither side. You can't kill their way out of this. And they have to make a new beginning.
He also at the Democratic convention in his speech, go back and look at it. He mispronounced Kamala's name all through the speech.
Oh, is it Kamala?
No, I think he said Kamala.
Oh, Kamala, yeah. It's you guys, the way you remember is Mamala.
By the way, at the Democratic convention, you could also see the speeches. You could see the text, the prepared text. And for a lot of the speakers, they did have her name like spelled out, you know, uh, phonetically, or not phonetically, but you know what I mean? So that they would be sure to pronounce it correctly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But Katie, maybe you had more questions, but I wanted to sort of ask Tom a question. Just thinking about this long history, the story of, you know, the Democrats shifting class allegiances that you were talking about earlier from the Atari Democrats today. You know, it's a 50-year story. It's a story that's been going on longer than my whole life, you know, at least from the Carter administration.
Not mine. I remember it. Yeah. I was there.
And yet there's also been this incredible acceleration just in the last 8 years, 2016 and today, where you really saw, Reagan won a landslide of working class voters, but they still stayed Democrat. They still voted for Democrats in the House. They still voted for senators. And now with this, this is a comprehensive wipeout. This means that from now on, the Democrats, literally, it's impossible for them to get more than basically 52 seats in the Senate. It means it puts a cap on, you know, without somehow transforming their working class support, they are just in a bunker. And in a funny way, they've been arrogantly pushing this for a long time, like you said, Tom, you know, and like, you know, the famous Chuck Schumer line, the kind of the story of the 21st century for every voter in, you know, working class voter in Western Pennsylvania, we're going to get a moderate suburb in Philadelphia. And yet I actually do think they tried, despite not doing the messaging that we wanted, they sort of were a little bit aware that they needed to try to get those voters. They had David Shore and his Blue Rose data group, you know, spending $700 million future forward money.
And they tried
to do these ads. But it's just funny, though, when you have a Democratic administration who presides over the economy that we saw, even though they did some decent things in spending and they did some even better things with labor, that is sort of off the map. They, when you actually have people experiencing the economy, they do. And then you have a 30-second ad being like, oh, yeah, I'm not rich as hell. Vote for Kamala. She's going to oppose the people who are rich. And meanwhile, you know, all of those voters know that the Democrats are sitting there with their billionaire friends and getting their own donors like Mark Cuban, et cetera.
At their convention, by the way, this is keep going. I interrupted.
No, I'm just going to ask you, like, so have things have changed in some ways and that they're, I think they're not actually, they weren't trying to do the Schumer strategy this year and that it happened to them anyway. Which is maybe in some ways more damning.
Well, why weren't they trying? By the end, they most definitely were trying.
I think they were trying.
Well, when you say they, are you talking about the campaign or are you talking about the governing?
I'm talking about the campaign. I think the campaign, I think Hillary did not even try to make a pitch. She thought that those voters were sewn up in the back. I mean, she famously, obviously, she didn't campaign in Wisconsin. Yeah. She never darkened the door of a union hall. Kamala did a lot of union hits.
Yes.
Kamala did, you know, she was trying to, she was doing that, the little girl gif, you know, why not both? She was trying to do, let's do Cheney and the and Tony West and reassure Silicon Valley. And let's also do the working class in a way that I think, you know, Biden did also did a little bit more of than Hillary and it helped him. And it didn't help her this time. And it just, it turns out maybe that doesn't matter that much in the face of the actual reality that is.
Well, look,
I don't know.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.